Welcome to Everyday Martial Artist, a weekly podcast where you'll join me, Brian Doucette, as I interview a different martial artist each episode and hear their story. Some guests you may have heard of, and some you probably haven't. Be sure to subscribe where all your favorite podcasts are available. Also, visit our website at everydaymartialartist.com. If you're listening for a specific interview, I sure hope you'll stay and check out the other episodes. A very special thank you to Topher Williams for our custom theme music. And now, the newest episode of Everyday Martial Artist. Everyday Martial Artist is brought to you by KOOnline.com for all your martial arts needs. Sparring and safety gear, rank belts, uniforms, weapons, patches, and more. Wholesale supplies made by martial artists for martial artists. Visit us today at KO-Online.com. Hello and welcome to Everyday Martial Artist. I'm your host, Brian Doucette. And as we do every week, we're joined by a brand new guest talking about their life and their journey throughout the world of martial arts. My guest today is a husband, father, retired corporate executive, U.S. Marine, podcast host, and martial artist. He built a successful career in corporate finance and has studied martial arts all of his adult life. He's traveled the world studying martial arts and has trained extensively throughout Europe, Asia, and the U.S., and he's the host of the BJJ Executive Podcast. Please welcome my guest today, Mr. David Kroll. How are you doing today, sir?
Brian, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, and thanks for putting this on. Really cool podcast, and I'm super happy to be a part of it.
I appreciate it. I truly appreciate your time, and I know you said you've listened to a few episodes, so you kind of know how we start things off. I want to go back to that beginning. I mentioned you've been doing it your whole adult life, but I want to know how that kicked off, where that first spark came from, that first interest in martial arts.
Yeah, I think it's so funny because these days, I mean, there's so much more information that's available to people. And so it's hard to imagine, like, if you rewind, and obviously I'm not like the oldest person that you've had on the podcast, but if you go back to somebody that's growing up in the 80s or the 90s, I mean, we didn't have YouTube, we didn't have any of this other, you know, clever information. And so the movies for me, I mean, that was kind of where it's at. And I hate to be a redundant sort of cog in the wheel, but The Karate Kid and some of those older movies, I mean, like, those are, that takes me back. And so, you know, sweeping the leg and, you know, like the mystique that came out of that. And there was just something to it. And it caught my attention, and, you know, the rest is history.
So then once it caught your attention, you know, first of all, what age when that happened? Because you said you didn't start training until your adult life. So during that time frame when you first had the interest until you actually started training, kind of what happened during that time and what led to that?
Well, I mean, there wasn't that much that was available, like, in my area. Okay. I grew up in St. Louis, and so we had a community center Taekwondo program, I don't know, maybe a 10-minute walk from my house. And I remember begging my parents, like, if you know, if my grades are good enough, or if I'm behaved well enough, or whatever the case might be, you know, could you sign me up for that? We had a karate school. I had no idea what kind of affiliation or what style of actually karate it was, that was in the area, and they're actually still there. But it was far away from the house. And I mean, this is me, like, combing the yellow pages, you know, to sort of circle ads and you know, compare and contrast, and things that I'd heard, things that I'd read in Black Belt magazine. But eventually, probably out of sheer convenience, I enrolled in a Taekwondo program. It was actually pretty good, even looking back at it in hindsight. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of how I got things going. You know, I would go two or three times a week, and, you know, we would do our forms, and every once in a while do some touch sparring and stuff like that. But otherwise, when I look back on it and I see some of the more intangible attributes that I would associate with a variety of different martial arts, including those that I participate in today, I can still see those even in those early stage kind of, you know, basic blocking and tackling community center Taekwondo programs. So that got me started, you know, and I don't do Taekwondo anymore. It would embarrass me if anybody were to see me throw a kick, but especially a Taekwondo kick, but that's the beginning for me.
Wow. Okay. So think back to your first couple of classes, and what are some things you remember about those first couple? You signed up, you got your, you know, parents agreed to it, you started going. What was it once you got there that kind of drew you in and made you think, wow, this is cool?
Yeah, I think that I am probably one of those types of people that's attracted to systems. And I remember thinking, like, I had a couple friends that were in class with me that was a brother and sister, for example. And I think they had been doing it for a couple years, and they might have been like green belts or brown belts. And again, I have no idea the order of the Taekwondo belts at this point. But mm-hmm. I remember thinking, like, wow, if I stick around for, you know, X amount of months, then, you know, I'm going to get promoted to a different belt. And this belt has some sort of maybe less meritocracy, but some level of hierarchy that comes along with it. And so what is it that I need to go and learn in order for me to be able to kind of bump myself up? And that's how I've operated in life in general. Like, you know, when I was in the military or when I was in the corporate world or whatnot, you know, you try to figure out what the rules of engagement are for whatever environment that you're in and, you know, apply a little ambition to them. And martial arts had that. It was actually run. It had a little bit of Korean sponsorship to it. I don't know if that was significant or not, but it was a retired U.S. Army guy that ran it with his family. And who knows? It could have inspired me in a lot of different ways that I haven't even really processed yet.
Wow. Now, did you at any point get involved in the competition side of Taekwondo?
Yes. Nothing. I mean, nothing like, you know, things that I've done lately, but there would be local tournaments, and I haven't, again, like I am so underqualified to talk about Taekwondo in general or the environment in general, but we would have community tournaments and in the St. Louis area. And some of them would be to do the forms. I think that's what they're called.
Yep.
And then some of them would be to do point-based sparring. And I would, anytime those things came through, we were sort of voluntold, I guess you could say. I mean, like if it was an affiliates type of a tournament that they were putting on, understandably, they'd want to get as much participation as they possibly could. And I loved it. It was, I had the trophies at home. I mean, some of them are probably participation trophies, you know, but also a few that were nice early wins when I was a teenager and kind of fun to sort of brag about. And then again, like seeing some of the things that I've participated in over the last 20 years or so, you know, ironically, I have to kind of give a lot of marble slab sort of martial art credit to that basic, like I said, blocking and tackling community center Taekwondo program. So,
and how long did you stay with that program?
Oh gosh, probably 5 or 6 years on and off through high school and middle school. Yeah, it was a thing to do, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just like a kid that is a hobbyist soccer or football player or whatnot, you know, like you need activities. And there was a gym there as well. And so, the fact that they kept the program going and basically all you needed to do was sign up again. It was really affordable. I mean, it was just sort of an activity. It was never like an ambition of mine or anything like that to go much further in it. But like anything, you know, you keep showing up, you keep going, you keep a little bit of consistency there. And even as a kid, you can get to the point where, you know, you can start putting a few things together. And yeah, I had a blast with it. Every once in a while, I remember a few years ago, my mom cleaned out some of the stuff in our house. Maybe it was my old room or maybe it was some boxes that she had, you know, long ago put some of this stuff in, but she sent me a text. She said, "Hey, do you want any of these old trophies?" You know? And I thought about it for a second, I got to admit, you know, but the anti-hoarder in me said, "No, go ahead and get rid of them."
I would have been like, "Yeah, I'll take them." But where am I going to put them?
I know. No, exactly. I would look at them for a little while. And then, you know, next thing you know, everybody that came to the house, I'd have to explain what it was like being 14 years old in St. Louis doing Taekwondo as a kid. So
well, that's actually really cool. And then do you remember what belt you got to?
Probably green or brown. I don't know. I don't know if there was any significance to them or not. Mm-hmm. But, you know, whatever belt you would get to as a 16 or 17 year old, I remember I had already enlisted in the Marine Corps when I started taking my, or when I ended my lessons, because I remember talking to the instructor that was there. And obviously he was a retired Army guy, as I mentioned. And so, you know, he obviously had some advice for me. And I remember having a nice, like little farewell and a good conversation with him. And that was sort of the end of it. Never heard from him, never thought about it again. And until now.
Okay. And one or two quick questions more about Taekwondo. Do you remember, did you ever get to do any board breaking?
I did not. We didn't do that.
Okay.
We didn't do that. They might've, I mean, who knows how that's evolved. I don't know any of the history of that or anything, but like in our particular program, we didn't. Yeah. We did a lot of the forms. I would have called them kata and karate. And then we did a lot of like touch sparring and stuff like that with pads and things like that on, you know, all rules based. I'm not sure how varying Taekwondo might be between different affiliations or whatnot, but
quite a bit actually. I've studied,
I'm sure.
I studied Taekwondo myself over 30 years and I've also dabbled in other systems of Taekwondo and multiple other styles also, but yeah, I've witnessed a lot of different, you know, Taekwondo, and there's the, you know, WTF and the ATA and the ITF and all these different organizations.
Yeah.
And even within those organizations, a lot of things do things their own way. So it's,
yeah,
I mean, you can have, you know, stay at a Taekwondo school for 10 years, you know, getting, you know, second, third degree black belt, move, start a whole new school, and it looks completely different than what you're doing. So it's, you know, unfortunately, a lot depends on, you know, that whoever started that system and what they taught and handed down, and it's, you know, very different. So it's, and that's with any style too. Same with karate, same with, you know, anything.
Sure. But
it's
just 100%.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's, and like I said, it's, you've been, you know, that was a long time ago. So not remembering it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, people ask me too, do you remember like your Tung Sido classes when you were 10? I remember the first class and that's it. I really don't remember much yeah. else. I remember one or two basic things we learned, and I'm still friends with that instructor, but I don't, you know, 40 years ago, I don't remember any of that stuff.
Yeah, so. No, it's, that's the real thing. And hey, look, I mean, I look back at that stuff and I mean, every kid, boy, girl, I mean, I think that there's something to any kind of activity, whether that's more physical sports like football or wrestling or something along those lines, but combative sports in general. I mean, I know I teach kids classes right now in jiu-jitsu, and one of the things that we'll see with kids that have been away from that environment is like even somebody putting their hands on them, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, it can be a really intimidating moment for them. And so getting kicked a few times, getting the wind knocked out of you, getting your bell rung, you know, or whatnot, even with pads on, I mean, that's a good experience to have in a controlled environment, a really positive instructor, somebody that's, you know, more of the role model type. Mm-hmm. I mean, from my perspective, even as a father, no matter what kind of affiliation they have, whether it would be frowned upon in the greater Taekwondo community or not, I mean, those big intangible pieces of it, you know, I'm thankful for it. And if that was all that was available in my area and my kids were in need of something like that, I wouldn't hesitate to put them into it, even though I'm sort of a through and through jiu-jitsu guy now. You know, those are the types of things that I would want for my kids, and, you know, certainly because I benefited from them. So, I mean, way to go, Taekwondo. Nice.
So at any point in the Taekwondo training, did you ever get involved in the teaching aspect when you were there, like assisting with classes or running warm-ups or anything?
No, nothing like that. I might have. I mean, if I did, it was a moment of irresponsibility on the instructor's part. There was no way that I would have been qualified for it. But again, you know, knowing me and knowing how my little brain works, I mean, I could see some of the hierarchy getting to me. And, you know, I'm an orange belt, you know, so bow before me or whatever the case may be. You know how kids can be. But no, I was pure play student.
Okay. And then you went, after that, you went into the Marine Corps. How long did that last? And was there any martial arts training at all while you were in the Marine Corps, or pretty much just focused on military life?
I did 5 years on active, 3 in the reserves. And while I was in the Marine Corps, I studied karate. I was stationed in Okinawa. And I mean, obviously, Kevin, even going back to the movies, I hate to, you know, throw out such an easy layout, but I mean, growing up watching Karate Kid, I mean, I obviously had sort of an affiliation for the area. I was dating an Okinawan woman who later became my wife and still is my wife to this day, happily married 24-ish, 25 years. Nice. Yeah. And I asked her, I said, hey, Hella, can you help me find a place to train karate? I want to find a local place. I want to stay off of the base. And I mean, I just stumbled myself into a gold mine, found a sort of back alley dojo from an older gentleman who is still alive today. His name is Takeshi Miyagi. He's a 10th degree black belt in Shorin-Ryu karate. And as hesitating as he was to take me in as a student, mm-hmm. because there is definitely a different mindset in a Western, more commercialized martial art environment that he would probably have overgeneralized, you know, based on, you know, where I was from, and something that's a little bit more traditional in Japan or in Okinawa. He became a father-like mentor to me, certainly with the time that I was on the island, and taught me a lot of good karate while I was there. Wow. So, yeah. And then, as you know, the Marine Corps, obviously, like many other branches of service, had various forms of fighting systems. And later on in my time in the Marine Corps, not while I was on active duty, but while I was in the reserve, I transitioned in to what has now become a very regimented part of their training called the Marine Corps Martial Arts Program, mm-hmm. which has a variety of different systems that it pulls from to create a combat-specific but familiar-looking system. And obviously, all Marines are trained on that.
Yeah, nice. So, I mean, I know a lot of people joke about this and they find a really cool instructor, but you literally found your Mr. Miyagi. That's kind of cool.
It's crazy. It's so funny. I mean, I'll tell people that. Like, I mean, Miyagi is such a common name. Exactly. There, you know, like which Smith is probably, or Jones. Yeah. It is exactly like that. Yep. Yeah, it's probably why they chose that for the movie, yeah. I would assume. But man, I'm telling you, what a great guy. He had one other American student that he had trained back in the 60s and 70s. His name was James Lilly. He lives in Ellicott City, Maryland right now, has oh, wow. also become kind of a distant friend. And when I transitioned back to the States, Mr. Miyagi had connected the two of us I remember he ripped off a return address from an envelope that they were just sort of pen-palling on. And connected me to him, and ultimately he helped me transition back into civilian life quite a bit, and then also hosted me up at his school up in Maryland so that I could train and sort of have a place to practice. Once again, another great example of what the community of this can provide, martial arts in general, you know. Nice.
So think back to that school in Okinawa then, and just kind of your first few thoughts compared to Taekwondo. I mean, they're obviously somewhat similar, but also a lot of differences between a traditional Okinawan karate and a Korean Taekwondo school. So what were some of the things that stood out when you first started?
Well, I mean, first of all, the training environment itself, certainly because of the location, was completely different. Mm-hmm. And so as a Westerner going in there, I mean, one of the reasons, and I sort of alluded to this, why he's had so few Western type students, and that might have changed to this day. I mean, since the flow of information is so much more readily available, it could have ended up being the case that more Western students flowed into his dojo. I don't know. But then it was more, man, we're just not sure if you're going to make it here, you know? So I remember him telling me, like, first of all, my wife kind of guided me into the dojo itself was literally in an alley, but it was behind his house. And so Okinawan homes are separated by these sort of concrete walls, and they're about 5 feet tall typically. And I'm 6 foot tall, like a lot of Americans. And so my big head is sticking out. I remember him sort of walking out kind of alarmed, you know, like, what is this? I mean, there's really no other reason for you to be here, you know? And I remember him looking at me very suspect. And he said, I was going on a trip to Guam. And I remember him telling me, look, if you still want to do this, come back. Here's the date and time. And if you show up, I'll train you. And so I showed up, and I remember there was a bunch of, it was an older crowd. So I would say the average student was probably in their 40s. Oh, wow. There weren't a lot of 30, 20 year olds. There were a handful, you know, but for the most part, these were all people that had been training for, you know, decades. And everybody was, you know, if you're familiar with the typical, I don't know, etiquette at a karate dojo, I mean, there's a lot of like makiwara work, which is mm-hmm. the beech wood where people are punching and using that to condition various parts of their arms and their hands and whatnot. There were people inside, you know, chit-chatting and doing their thing. But when we got to, when we started, it was a, you know, kind of cold stretch, you know, probably not the most modern sort of physical type of work, but it was something that they likely had been doing for, you know, 50 plus years. And then we got right into it. And the thing was, it's like, you're not really a customer, you know, whereas in the Taekwondo school, there clearly was some commercial element to it. You know, there was, we want you to come back. And so there was a little bit of salesmanship to the parents. So there's some, you know, probably unwarranted encouragement, I would say, to some of the students that were having a more difficult time. This was very much a, look, this is what we do. If you can do it. If you can't, then don't, you know? And if he wasn't making a lot of money on it. I think I paid him like 5,000 yen a month, which would have been like $40 today. And that was my impression, you know? And so you don't go through a system where it's like, these are the 6 or 7 moves you need to know in order to get to the next stripe or whatnot. And we're not going to give you little micro promotions or whatnot. Mm-hmm. This is the kata that we start with. You don't know it yet. And so we're going to teach you that first. And when you're finished with that, we're going to teach you the next one. No, you cannot skip to the fourth one that you think is better. You know, mm-hmm. No, you're not ready to do that move that you see in some of those that are a little bit more advanced. And we would go through the progression in the class where we would work kata after kata after kata through a different types of systems. And as your knowledge is expended, and as you're not, you know, sort of moved on to the next one, you would just simply bow out and you'd wait for the rest of the class to finish. And when the class finished, then and went through the entire sequence of the kata that are in that particular system of karate, then we would then start specializing. So he would say,
Okay.
David, you're going to move on to the Nihonshu series or the Pinyin series or whatever the case may be, and this person right here is going to work with you on it. And so that's a lot different than you might experience at
Yeah.
a even an American style karate school that has the exact same types of karate. It's just a different culture, So
Nice. And how long were you able to train there? How long were
I
you able to
trained for
train?
a few years. I probably
Nice.
2 or 3 years. And every single day I went, it was probably a 10-minute walk from the apartment that my wife and I had.
Okay.
And I can still remember the smells and I, the same endorphin release that you get when you train today. I remember sort of, rolling my gi up and tying my belt around it, getting changed over. We would clean the dojo together at the end of class. I mean, we would do what I guess probably the American word would be like deck toweling. We'd wipe a bunch of towels or get a bunch of towels soaked in water, and then we'd run them along the pine woods, clean things up, close things off, and then, we'd all kind of go off on our way. And I still remember like the feelings that I would get when I would walk home, and see people that are sort of like, what's this crazy guy doing in my alley? But one of the most profound experiences that I've had in my life, and it's not something that I could really replicate anywhere else. So I just sort of have to accept that what I was given is what was given, and just take that experience for what it is. So,
And was there any kind of
yeah.
rank attained while you were there?
I mean, this is difficult to measure because in Okinawa, to achieve the rank of black belt isn't like achieving the rank of black belt in like Brazilian jiu-jitsu or something, which might take a decade to get to. So I received my black belt probably 2 months before I went back to the
Oh,
States.
wow. Okay.
I remember I had gotten a brown belt after a year or so, and it was more like Miyagi-sensei came in and he said, "Hey, in his way of saying it, David, you're a brown belt today." There was no ceremony or anything
No
like that. He
test,
just no, he just gave me a brown belt and said, "Don't wear
yeah.
the white one today." But when I got my black belt, I remember I knew that there was a it was sort of an annual thing, and there was a ceremony in the greater Okinawa area that was with other schools as well, and we were, I was going to go to it anyway. I had no thoughts at all that I would be one that would be promoted. And myself and another person that had started training with me was a Japanese man who was probably, I don't know, a decade or so older than I was at the time. We both got our black belts together that day. And it was amazing. It was a lot of fun. And something again that, I mean, I just can't believe I was lucky enough to have had that experience.
That is so cool. Wow, what a story. All right, so then what was next after you left Okinawa? What was next?
Well, I mean, I guess just keeping it on the martial arts journey, I had, well, when I came back to the States, I just had a hard time finding that, like I really wanted to remain involved in it. It was something that I thought quite a bit about, and I was in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. That was where my last duty station was in the Marine Corps, and I mean, this is a massive metroplex, and so like to get from the west side of the metroplex to the east side of the metroplex, I mean, that could be 90 minutes away. And again, we're still in the pre-9/11 phase at this point, and so like, I mean, I'm in yellow pages mode. Like the internet isn't as useful back then as it is today. And I remember finding a couple karate schools that were in the metroplex area. One of them in particular seemed pretty legit, and it was a good hour away. And I remember driving out there one night to check it out. And while the instruction was good and the environment was good, especially looking back at it today, it was missing a lot of what I had in Okinawa for obvious reasons. And so I never pursued any further karate other than going up to Maryland and training with the guys up there. I just couldn't find, what I was looking for. And so I would say probably it was around 2003. I was in the reserves, and after September 11th, I had gotten activated back into the active duty for 6 months. It was just the way it was back then. If you think back 20 years, I mean, the wars were just getting started, and so it was kind of like a state of disarray, especially as a reservist. A lot of different training happened during that time, and one of the things that I did was a 2 week series to get myself up to speed on what had become, a well indoctrinated martial arts program, as I mentioned before, inside the Marine Corps. So I guess taking a step back, when people go through Marine Corps boot camp now, and I might be way outdated here, but like they will go through the initial training. They'll get a belt level, right? And as they get out into the fleet, you know, that training progresses. I hadn't gone through anything like that, so I had to kind of get a crash course to get up to a certain level that was commensurate with my rank. And so we had instructors that came in from Quantico, Virginia, which is where the headquarters location was for the training programs. And I remember we were watching like old UFC videos. These are like VHS tapes to illustrate moves. And so like these are still things that are like, you know, brand new to a lot of people. And I had seen this stuff on video in the barracks and whatnot, you know, but I'd never really spent much time thinking about it. And of course, you know, you look back at it now, and these are now infamous fights, like the various fights that Hoist Gracie had in the first few UFCs, where he did, you know, bracket style matches that night. He would take on three or four guys, and he's pulling out things which now, of course, we know are very common, like, oh wow, that's an armbar, that's a triangle, or he's got the mount or whatever. I mean, these are very common, well-established positions now, and you can, I mean, have an innumerable amount of hits if you were to go and research them. But that was sort of my introduction to Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And once I got into that and realized that there's this whole new world, one, I realized how singular my focus was and how I had become very one-dimensional, and things that I thought were very effective actually could be neutralized quite easily. And while I do believe that martial arts supplement one another, and it is good to have a very holistic mindset, I had no answer for the ground. I had no answer for general grappling, whether it was stand-up grappling or ground grappling. And then I went on a quest to, you know, kind of to remediate that knowledge gap. And so that's what's next for me.
So kind of walk us through some of that. Walk us through some of your experiences in the early days of your BJJ training. And you had been used to, you know, pretty much stand-up styles before that. And then, like you said, you watched the UFC stuff, you had to learn some ground stuff. Do you remember the first time, like, you were in someone's guard, or someone had you, like, in a chokehold, and just the thoughts that went through your head?
Yeah, I mean, we did it in the military training. We would do grappling matches. You know, they would be probably what you would consider today as standard no-gi matches, right? Because we would do them in like utility bottoms and then our green t-shirts, right, with our boots on, or maybe with our boots off. And you know, maybe you start on your knees, maybe you start standing up. But I mean, I do remember like the exhaustion from going on like a 3 or 4 minute round. Like if you're not ready to exert yourself like that, or if you're not used to that, if you weren't a wrestler or something that would have sort of conditioned you for that type of work, I mean, I do remember the nauseating feeling, the literal nausea that you get from, you know, one, the shock to your central nervous system, all the adrenaline dumping, you know, just having to sort of recall and then apply techniques that when you're doing them statically work really well. And then all of a sudden, when there's a dynamic environment, they go kind of away. I remember that feeling. And that feeling transferred into my first night at a formal jiu-jitsu school. I was probably 28 years old. A couple years had passed since this. And I had started to get a little bit deeper into my career in finance. And like most mid-career people, I mean, I found myself like completely out of balance in life. And I said, look, I got to get a new hobby. Let me get back to martial arts. Found a jiu-jitsu school, went and trained. And I remember I had my young son with me. He was 7 years old at the time. He was sitting on the wall. I was allowed to spar for the first time. And I remember sitting on the wall after a couple rounds thinking, there's no way I'm going to make it out the door without puking. And I told him, I'm like, we got to go. We got in the car, and I ended up having to pull over into a parking lot. So, and I'm still in pretty good shape at the time, you know? And so, that was from then on, jiu-jitsu became my thing. I was hooked. And, you know, I've made a ton of moves in jiu-jitsu. I've gone from school to school because of moves that I've had to make in my life. But, you know, that has sort of become, you know, the martial art and the route that I'm the most comfortable in now.
Talk me through then how you chose that first jiu-jitsu school. And then you said you've had to move to other schools and stuff. What is your process then after having experience in jiu-jitsu? What is your process in choosing your next school?
First of all, the process for choosing the school then was pretty simple, because this would have been 2007. And even though that was a good 20 years into jiu-jitsu being in the United States, It was very much less commercialized than it is right now. And that's not a bad thing. That just shows the evolution of that particular martial art in the United States over the last 20 years. So there weren't that many choices. I had a spot that was, we were living in Fort Lauderdale at the time. There was a spot that was, on the north side of an hour radius, and there was a spot that was on the south side, So it was kind of like pick which one is your poison. And this one was within a reasonable distance from where my office was, and it was as simple as that. And I remember going in there and meeting these guys, and I happened upon a night when they had a fundamentals class, and it was a really tame environment. And when I came back from my first real live class, one of the advanced classes was finishing up. It was a no-gi session, and I remember the place was just packed. It was full of guys that were a lot bigger, a lot stronger, a lot more athletic than I was. We're just beating the crap out of each other, and the windows are all fogged up and stuff. And I'm like, oh my gosh, like this is, there's something that scares me about this. And because of that, like, there's just no way that I can not do it. So that's how I chose it. And of course, like, it's very similar anywhere you go. Now I'm older, so there's some other things that I need to sort of pay attention to. Like, for example, I don't want to go to a school where I feel like the environment is such that I'm going to get myself hurt. I wouldn't recommend that for somebody that's young and in shape either, but certainly, I'm not going to go to a school that is full of, I don't know, 24-year-old Division I wrestlers that are looking to go and get their next world championship out of the way. Those are not the type of people that I'm going to be able to hang with, and I'll just end up, hurting myself. Nowadays, what I look for is a place that I can connect to the community. I think that in the martial arts world, the value of our community is one of the most underrated items that we have got. I've seen it turn people's life around. I've seen it bring people that are suffering from different types of depression, different types of just like lack of utility in their life, reach into this community, dig deep, and blossom into something that you would have never expected. And there's a lot of different little clues for that along the way, right? A lot of it is how you feel when you meet with the instructor. Is it a family environment? How do they differentiate between a beginner's program and an advanced program? Do they have a competition specific class? Do they have a fundamental specific class? Like, just little things, maybe no red lines, but just probably a culmination of attributes that I would sort of, I don't know, not test for, I suppose, but that I'm kind of informally probing on when I go and look for a place to train. For the most part, when I've gone to a school, I can only account a few instances of places that I've said, this is categorically not for me. There is no way that I'm going to train at this place. For the most part, there's a lot of schools out there that are perfectly adequate, and I count myself really lucky having trained at the schools that I have trained at, including the one that I'm at right now. But those are the types of things that I would look for if I was going in and trying to find a new place to train.
And do you remember your very first BJJ tournament?
I do. My very first BJJ tournament is probably identical to the type of competition track record I have today, which is 100% hardcore mediocre. it's crazy, Brian, because like both of my kids are really good wrestlers. Like, they wrestled all through high school. My older son wrestled in college, and wrestlers compete every weekend. Like, it's no big deal, like you're gonna wrestle probably 50 or 60 matches in a year. But for some reason, like when we do martial arts tournament, it becomes like this really big deal. And so I've always had a hard time competing and going out there and like really feeling like I'm representing as good as I can do. And it's something that I'm working on still to this day, and it's getting better. But I remember really psyching myself up. I was a white belt. Again, I'm 28, 29 years old. I remember going out there, and yeah, I won my first match by a really fluke injury that the other guy had. I either got taken down or I pulled guard. I'm not sure which. I swept him, and when I came up, I mounted him, and all of a sudden he's crying about his ribs. And I'm like, I'm a champion. I won my first match. This is all for me. And then I got absolutely cremated on the second one. That's the way it is. You get up, and I competed a few more times after that. And then to this day, I stay pretty active in the local competition circuits. I travel a bit if there's a tournament within a few hours radius. I think it's a fun weekend event to go do and try yourself in competition. And as you know, I'm sure it's similar in the Taekwondo world or the karate world or whatnot. A lot of people tend to sort of do this together. And so there's people in a lot of schools that kind of travel together. I'm at the division now where there's just not that many of us. I'm a master's four brown belt in jiu-jitsu. I mean, this isn't, the stuff of the Olympics or of the scholarships or whatnot. So the folks that are out there going at it, I mean, we tend to kind of stick together, and I'll see guys that travel in from Phoenix. I meet them in Austin, and then the next tournament might be in Dallas or Oklahoma City or something like that. And I'll see the same people again. It's fun to reconnect and catch up and then go out there, of course, and throw all the friendship out the door and then compete,
Right. And you had mentioned a little earlier about your teaching a kids class. So when did teaching become something that interested you?
Oh, good question. I mean, teaching is one of those things that, first of all, it's hard to find the opportunity to teach. And in a lot of schools, to teach a kids class, for example, might be something that's just simply offloaded onto a local teen or something like that. A lot of times the classes themselves are at like 4 o'clock or something that's not very conducive to somebody who's working, a standard US business hour. As my calendar has freed up a little bit more, I just became really active in networking on it. And it started with our school. Like we have a really strong affiliate network at my current school. I train at a place called Double Five under a guy named Rafael Formiga Barbosa. He's a really well-known jiu-jitsu guy in the community. And because he's also a really good human being as well. And because of that, he has encouraged a lot of his black belts to go off and start schools. And there's a lot of schools that are in our area. And so I just started by talking to all these people. And the conversation's really simple. It's, hey man, look, I need the reps. You're doing this, 6, 7 days a week, sometimes the morning, noons, and nights, and maybe even working on, another job as well. To the extent that I could shoulder some of that burden for you, it would be a win-win. I don't
Nice.
make any money doing it. I just simply found that like I really enjoy it. It's helped improve my jiu-jitsu in a material way, and I can't even begin to describe the personal benefits that I've gotten just by getting to know the kids and the parents, helping them improve. And so, yeah, I think that for anybody that's training, I imagine this translates across all martial arts. As soon as you can get involved in teaching, if you're willing to commit to it, of course, that is. First of all, the older you get, the more things that you need to do out of hard rounds, because there's only so many of those you get, right? And this is a way that not only can you give back to the local community and to your schools and actually be helpful and whatnot, but it's another way that is probably, I mean, I'm young, I'm 45 years old. So, I mean, I've got a lot of road to hoe still, but I do realize that the days of doing 5 and 6 rounds 5 days a week, those are done. I don't know if there's a I might not have another week like that left in me, honestly. Like I have to really be careful about how my training goes. And so to be involved, to keep your timing down, to keep the vocab down, to keep your head in the game, like all of those things, teaching provides that. And while not everybody is open to it, like I had some people say, no, I'm good, I don't need the help. Cool, no problem. Even my instructor was happy to have the help from time to time. And once you start getting on the radar of people, now I've got routine classes. And so then you can start to really get to know the students, get to know their needs. And like I said before, I mean, some of the personal satisfaction that's come out of seeing somebody, especially like take a 5 or 6 year old kid, for example, that is shy as can be when they walk in, that maybe even cried the first time somebody pushed them down. And then you watch them evolve over the course of literally either sometimes days, but weeks or months or whatnot into somebody that's just like one, learning how to take a beating a little bit. I mean, that's probably not the best way to describe it, but I mean,
It's
you know, it's
true.
physical. It is, right? I mean, it's physical a bit, but also like the ability to learn how to lose, right? I mean, you're not always going to be the toughest kid in the class. And, you're going to have to, sort of at an early age, learn to subordinate your ego a little bit, whether or not you know you're doing it or not. And I just can't say enough good things about it. It's been one of the most fulfilling and enriching pieces of my martial arts journey to date.
That is cool. I know for me, the biggest thing I get out of it is I learn my own techniques better when I teach them to someone else. It
Right? That's so true.
proves my own martial arts. That's why my instructors always, when whenever someone needed extra help before a test, I'd always volunteer. I'll come in on the weekend. I'll work with them, and I would never take money for it. They tried to, and I'm like, no. And I always, like, whenever I see, like, a new student and I'm helping a class, I'm like, hey, if you ever want extra practice, and most of them never call me. And I told them, I said, just so you know, I offer this to, like, 20, 30 people a year and maybe one or two call. I said, if I can't do it, I'll tell you. But if I'm right. available, I will come in here with you, and it helps me as much as it helps you. And a lot of them don't get that. So it's
so true.
Yeah, for me, that, you know, I haven't taught an actual class in a long time, but the one-on-one stuff, I really enjoy it. I haven't taught a class in over 20 years probably myself, but
maybe
a little less, but...
I totally agree. I am, and I'm glad you brought that up, because that's another element of it as well. I have mats in my garage, nice. And I'll invite, like, you know, we're becoming kind of like this, you know, we sort of niche ourselves together a little bit. And even though I've been training jiu-jitsu for the last, you know, whatever, 16 or 17 years, I still have a 45-year-old body. And so, like, I've had to modify the way that I'm training. Mm-hmm. So when I see somebody that comes in, maybe a little bit out of shape in their mid-30s, or maybe hitting into the 40s, or even in their 50s, I feel like I can help them quite a bit. And the most heartbreaking thing for me is to watch somebody that comes in, tries to compare themselves to somebody that's 20 years old, that is, you know, just has testosterone spilling out of their eyeballs, is super athletic. And, you know, they're like, oh, well, I'm never going to be that. No, that's absolutely not the case. There's 100% a place for you in this. And you just need somebody to show you the way to get there. And exactly the same experience that you just mentioned, where if one thing is with kids, right?
Yeah.
Where if you think you can do a, you know, I don't know, fill in the blank, double under guard pass or something like that. Okay, great. Well, go teach that to those group of 6-year-olds that don't know how to do a forward roll. And then tell me how well you know it. And the other thing is, when you've got a 40-year-old that hasn't done anything other than maybe throw a softball in the last 20 years, and you're teaching them how to be comfortable with that 20-year-old aggressor on top of them for a 5-minute round, you know, and see that it actually works. It sounds like we have a very similar vein there, where if more people would take you up on that, I have a similar ratio. It's probably 30-1, like you said.
Yep. I know. It's crazy. A couple that I know, if I ask them, they'll show up. But other ones were like, they have my number and I'll never hear from them. And then it was funny. I remember one time when he was doing that, and one gentleman that I offered it to, he had started after these other guys, but the instructor's like, you know, hey, can you work with him and get him ready so he can test with them for his belt? Because he was like, maybe he started like a month after them or something like that. And I offered to all of them. I said, hey, if you all want to come in this weekend, and he's the only one that showed up. And he ended up testing same night. And I think he, like, one of them didn't pass and he did. And they're like, wow, how'd you, like, cause I went in with Mr. Brian, he offered. They're all like, serious. I'm like, like 15 years ago, I had a group of four guys that I made the offer to. And I said, well, how early are you willing to? Cause we have a weird job. I said, I'll come in at 5 a.m. And for like 9 months, we were in 5 days a week at 5 a.m. working out.
Wow.
And that was probably the best shape of my life when we were doing that.
Yeah.
It was
well, there's no way that their skill level didn't improve materially after that as well.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the consistency and the time and the one-on-one, I mean, it's like rocket fuel to level up. I mean, I mean, you've probably experienced that yourself as well. Like, I know I have for sure, like going to an open mat, for example, where I have people there that, you know, look, we jive with different people, you know, like our skill sets match up well and not well with, depending on who the other person is. And there's definitely people that I've had in an open mat or after class or whatnot, where just sitting there for 15 minutes and troubleshooting a few things has made like meaningful leaps in terms of either troubleshooting an issue that I was having, or, you know, sprouting a seed that was planted years ago by somebody who I just couldn't get the next step with, you know? So it's crazy. Too many people don't understand that. Like, we're stuck in the hierarchy of things sometimes and forget that, like, look, Q&A is a part of this, and it's a part of the exploration process, and we all need it.
Right. So talk a little bit about the BJJ Executive Podcast, kind of what led to that, and what can people expect if they check it out?
Well, the BJJ Executive Podcast originally was a brainchild that I had on trying to connect the jiu-jitsu world with a higher level of business. Mm-hmm. And what I started realizing through that process is that it really doesn't have to have anything to do with business. what I'm looking to do, the perfect avatar for me is probably a 35-year-old male or female that has a lot of different things in their life. Maybe it's family, maybe it's career, maybe it's sports, maybe it's, a variety of different issues. And they're sitting there with everything tied for first, and they've just simply put jujitsu at the bottom of it. And what I like to do is interview people that, maybe are successful in business, maybe started their own business, maybe run their own academy or whatever the case may be. And then we start just dissecting the journey. So somebody's gotten up to black belt, right? They've trained jiu-jitsu for 15 years. Most likely they've gone through some kind of a surgery. In many cases, we'll uncover that they took 2 years off because of some issue that happened and they thought they were never coming back. And so, like, in short, what I'm looking to do is take people who have been successful, and in most cases, as you've probably noticed in the variety of different interviews that you've had over the years, people leave clues behind when they're successful. So success leaves clues. And we take those, and those clues are going to mean something different to different people. But like, if I can help that 30, 40-year-old white belt that's walking in the door and is like, what is this world that I'm walking into? Then that's the purpose right there. And so everybody gets a little something different out of each interview. Honestly, some of the most feedback that I've gotten has just been sort of having informal conversations with black belts in the academy or whatnot, and talking through some of the etiquette, just sort of some of the unwritten rules. Like, for example, one of the most commented pieces that I had gotten was a conversation that I was having actually with my instructor, where we were talking about, I happened to have been injured at the time. I had a really bad rib injury and I had a hard time going hard, but I wanted to be a part of it still. And so we were talking about how I was coming in, getting some technique in, but I was sort of like feeling weak and sitting on the side and whatnot. And he's like, look, you, I just want you here. You're training still, And a lot of people were like, oh my God, like I took 6 months off because I tore my, MCL. I didn't know I could come and like be a part of it still, I mean, so just exposing some of these things, is that's what I'm after. And, anybody that tunes in and listens, some episodes are going to speak to you. Some people have a very similar background. They like, for example, for me, I spent a lot of time in finance. And so people hearing my story and saying like, well, look, this guy spent the hours. I mean, we work notoriously long hours doing these types of things. Somehow you've strung together enough consistency in classes and had to make these, make your training a priority. Maybe I can do it too, So anyway, that's the hope, and it's been an absolute blast putting these things together.
And how often do you release an episodes?
Well, my this is an area where I could use a little help, so I could probably take some of my own medicine. I originally was releasing two a month, and I've generally kept the pace with that. When I first started it off, I was doing only long form interviews. And so I have a home studio. You and I talked a little bit earlier about kind of our respective setups. And, so somebody will come to my house, we'll do a, nice little warm up, get to know each other a little bit, and then we'll just hit play and go from there. You put a lot into those. And so I've got two different types of episodes that I put out now. One I call an open mat. And so an open mat might be me and Brian get together, right? You and I know each other. We've gotten a chance to spend a couple hours recording episodes for our podcast together. And now we're just going to pick apart a topic like the latest UFC or, I don't know, fill in the blank, any different number of topics. And so, yeah, about twice a month, I'll put an episode out, and having the shorter form stuff that's a little bit more informal helps keep the pace up on that a little bit.
Nice. And I will definitely put a link out there for people to check that out for sure. So, and
Thank you very much.
you mentioned the UFC a few times. You mentioned you watched it back in the day on VHS and stuff. And I'm just curious, overall, what are your thoughts on MMA and the UFC? Is that something you're a fan of?
I'm not a fan, but I pay almost no attention, and I've just sort of fallen out of it since. I don't know. It's become. I think it's a great thing that the sport has been commercialized, but now the unintended consequence of that is that it's so frequent now, it's just taken some of the pizzazz away. So 15 years ago, I would have been the guy that had a UFC party at my house, and we all pitch in to get the $100 pay-per-view, and can't wait to see it again in 3 months. Now I can't keep up, so I don't follow any fighters in particular, and it's just not really my thing.
Okay, that's fine. So in all your years of martial arts, starting way back when in Taekwondo through karate and all your years of BJJ, is there one philosophy you've learned that is at the top of your list?
Well, first of all, I don't know if you would consider this a philosophy or not, but one of the things that I have learned in every single one of the martial arts is that an element of humility and the ability to subordinate your ego will take you a long way. And it is something that I've had to work on and have to continue to work on to this day. Jiu-jitsu, which is a very hands-on combat sport in which hard training, sparring rounds are a very integral part of the training, it will eat you alive if you're having to spend a bunch of time in the car home kind of dissecting why you did bad at something. You know, you just simply have to accept that, like, look, this is just part of the journey. And so a lot of the problems that are kind of rooted from that are just a lack of humility and a lack of being able to sort of put your ego to the side and just allow the process to kind of take you along where it's going to take you. And when I look back to my time in Okinawa, when I look back to my time even at the community center, I suppose, you know, that link right there sticks. And I think if more people would embrace that a little bit. And when you start thinking about times when maybe I'm not as excited to go train or I didn't have as good a time training, most of the time it's not because, like, oh, I think I could have lived up to a little bit higher to standards. Most of the time it's because your ego's hurt or you lack a little bit of humility. And it's hard to answer that question. It's hard to look in the mirror and say that. But I feel like that philosophy right there, certainly as I get a little bit older and the victories are a little bit fewer and far between, especially with some of the younger guys, that is something that I've had to go back to time and time again. And I suspect that's only going to become more important for me. And because of that, I feel like that's sort of a central tenet to what the martial arts are at their core. You know?
I like it. Nice. All right. I got a few fun questions to wrap it up. So the first one here, this one doesn't have to be four. I've had people give as few as two and as many as eight, but three, four, five names that you would put on your personal Mount Rushmore of martial arts.
Oh my gosh. That's crazy. Well, I would probably put, I'm going to go with Elio Gracie. He changed jiu-jitsu. I mean, there's no question. I do not fall into any of the nonsense of the sects of jiu-jitsu these days, which is American jiu-jitsu, Brazilian jiu-jitsu, or whatnot. Like, there is no question that he fathered a form of martial arts that has now become so commercialized that it is on every street corner in the United States. Mm-hmm. He belongs up there 100%. I'm going to put Daniel LaRusso up there because he is a childhood hero of mine. Nice. And I mean, I haven't watched any of the new Karate Kid or anything that's on Netflix.
Yeah, no, Cobra Kai. Dude, it's
I haven't.
So
I can't. Is cool. it? Man, I mean, I I've that. Had. I feel like it's going to let me down. You know, like this is such a core part of my childhood.
So I thought that when the very first, all right, I'm going to watch one episode, then I can tell everyone how bad it was, and next thing you know, I'm like six episodes, and I'm like, this is so cool.
That is amazing.
Yep, I love it.
I would put Takeshi Miyagi up there. He was my instructor in Okinawa, and how much technique I remember from those days is very questionable. If I were to start doing some of those katas, most likely I would end up with a hip injury or some sort of a rotator cuff problem. Mm-hmm. But not because of the karate that he taught me, but because of the mentorship he gave me, which, as I've mentioned multiple times throughout this, like, I see that as such a, in some places, missing part of the martial arts community in general. It's omnipresent. There's a lot of really good examples of it. But until you experience that as a whole, I don't think you've experienced martial arts for what it can be. He is the first person that showed me that. And he absolutely belongs on the Mount Rushmore. And I personally am internally grateful to him.
Nice.
And the last person that I would put up there is a guy named Bruce Belfield.
Okay.
He probably doesn't listen to the podcast. He's sort of an anomaly, but he was my jiu-jitsu instructor in Fort Lauderdale. I trained at the Valente Brothers Academy in Fort Lauderdale. I'm a very self-defense focused school. And I remember Bruce, he and I were the same age. We had a lot of things in common. And I remember him pulling me aside one night and that same kind of conversation where we talked about doing one-on-one training. And I remember him saying, like, look, let's work one-on-one together And I promise you that you will have a lot more fun doing your jiu-jitsu. He was watching me suffer through a lot of things trying to use strength and athleticism. And he's the first person that really started to build a foundation of defense, which I use to this day. The reason I think that he belongs on the Mount Rushmore is because in this Instagram-laden world where people are putting 16-second reels of their most highlighted moments and whatnot, Bruce isn't a competitor. He isn't a name that's ever going to be on the Hall of Fame within jiu-jitsu. That's not something that's important to him at all. But if it wasn't for him, my jiu-jitsu simply wouldn't be what it is today. And because of that, he's the fourth head that I would put up there.
I
And
like
I could go on and give you five,
it.
six, seven, and eight. There's
Yep.
all kinds of jiu-jitsu heroes and martial arts heroes that I've got. But if I had to pick four, I think that Elio Gracie, Daniel LaRusso, Takeshi Miyagi, and Bruce Belfield would be great representatives of sort of what encompasses martial arts and myself.
Awesome. I love it. All right. Do you have a favorite martial arts book?
No, I really don't. One of the most enjoyable martial arts books that I've read is a book on called Ways to Die in Tokyo. And it's written by a guy named Tom Garver.
Okay.
Tom is a black belt that I met when I lived in Tokyo 4 or 5 years ago. I was there studying the Japanese language in 2017. And of course, I enrolled in a jiu-jitsu school while I was there. And I remember being really lonely, like being sort of an outcast. I couldn't speak the language very well. And obviously we're training and whatnot. Tom was the first guy to take me under his wing and say, he's a corporate attorney at a large US corporation in Tokyo. And he's like, hey, let's go get a steak tonight. And I remember being so happy. And after that, Tom and I stayed in touch. He's gotten his black belt out in Tokyo now. And he wrote a book called Ways to Die in Tokyo. It is very much about martial arts. It's a novel, it's a fiction book, obviously, but it's sort of, for any martial artist, it's a really cool read. And there's not a lot of them that are out there like that. So that's I don't know if you'd call that a martial arts book or not, but again, Ways to Die in Tokyo by Tom Garver.
I will check it out. Awesome. How about a favorite martial arts video game? Do you ever get into gaming?
I did. I mean, like nowadays, the old school Street Fighter and Kung Fu games from the Nintendo Entertainment System. I mean, those would probably be, I don't know if you would call it analog or 8-bit or whatever the terminology might be, but those are the games that I played when I was a kid. So I can still remember the code to beat Contra, and I can still remember, all of the five or six levels in NES Kung Fu, and that would have been my probably martial arts video game of choice.
Very cool. I like that. All
Yeah,
right.
jump kick, side kick, and a punch, man. What else do you need?
Nice. Nice.
Maybe a couple trips.
There you go. How about a favorite martial arts TV show?
Favorite martial arts TV show. I remember growing up watching Walker, Texas Ranger, seeing
Nice.
Chuck Norris do his thing, wait for the imminent fight scene that would have come. I don't know that there's that many that are out there these days that I would have watched, but I mean, those would have been the ones that sort of kind of allured me back in the day. Now you can get your fix in different ways. You can
Yep.
see matches live or whatnot, but it is kind of hard to remember for folks or hard to understand for folks that, back when it was just sort of whatever network TV had, you had to take what you could get. And that would have been one of them for me.
That was a
I don't
great
know if
show.
that's going to expose me or
Yeah,
whatnot.
that's a
So
good
anybody
point.
that's listening, please don't judge. But yeah, man, Walker, Texas Ranger and Chuck Norris. Who doesn't like that?
Great show, and I remember a handful of episodes of Machado Brothers were on too, so
That's right, man.
yeah,
That's right.
that's cool.
100%.
All right, well, this one I might already know the answer to, but we'll see. How about a favorite martial arts movie?
I mean, you definitely know the answer. It's 100% the original Karate Kid from whatever it was, 1984 or whatnot.
Yep, June
I
of
remember
1984.
watching it in the theater. Is that right? Yeah,
Yep.
awesome. Yeah, I mean, and followed right behind it, Karate Kid 2. I mean, those right there, as sort of corny as it is, and as critical as people can be on the effectiveness of it or whatnot, or what they would have done if Johnny swept the leg, man, it changed things a little bit for me. And that's the one.
No, I've told the story. My listeners are probably sick of hearing about it by now, but literally June of 1984, I went to opening night of The Karate Kid with my friends, 10 years old. And as we're walking
Awesome.
out of the movie theater, local Tung Sidot school standing in the lobby, handing out free passes. So
Oh, that's amazing.
that's what literally launched my martial arts journey was that movie.
That is
So,
awesome. That is so cool.
it's, that'll always be my number one. What's funny is, you know, you talked about you haven't seen Cobra Kai yet, which seriously, do me a favor and watch the first episode.
I will.
But I talk to people who have like watched Cobra Kai and have never seen the original Karate Kid. I'm like, wow.
No first way. All, how missing, can you not?
Well, the thing is, they're missing so many little Easter eggs. Like,
yeah.
Like, you have to. I watched the original Karate Kid at least once a year, minimum. When Cobra Kai came out, I rewatched all of them. And then I've rewatched the whole Cobra Kai series probably 5 times already. So,
okay. You might be the one that pushes me over. It's a good sell. So I'll have to go and check it out.
Like I said, you know, some of the fight scenes are a little over the top, and you know, the whole thing that a lot of the issue people have with the first one is that how did he get to the level that he could beat a black belt in like 3 months? Well, you see the same thing in Cobra Kai. I mainly watch it for the nostalgia. And there's a lot of it. I mean, because it's a lot of the original actors. I've had a couple people that have been on that show and the original Karate Kid series on my podcast, which is awesome. And it's a lot of fun. I think you'd enjoy it. If you're that much of a fan, I think you'll enjoy it.
I am. I will absolutely check it out. You definitely pushed me over. So.
Awesome. All right. Final question. This one doesn't necessarily have to be a martial arts movie, just any movie you've ever seen, a favorite movie fight scene.
Oh man, I sure wish Top Gun had a fight scene in it, because that's by far my favorite movie. Let's just go with that then. I mean, like the combative nature of it, for sure. That was a foundational movie for me. If I had to go hardcore martial arts, then I'm going to go with something like Under Siege. And the allure of watching Steven Seagal, you know, with his Aikido and all of his different moves and whatnot. I mean, like, that would have been another sort of, I guess you could have call it like the marble slab or whatnot of my upbringing.
Some good ones on. So I gotta ask you then, as a Top Gun fan, did you love Maverick?
No, I didn't. That's really? The thing, and that's part of that. Yeah, that's part of my hesitance with going towards the Cobra Kai.
Okay.
I gotta admit, and this will—I mean, definitely nobody judge on this one—but the opening scene of Maverick, where they mimic the beginning, where they had a modern day carrier, mm-hmm. and the new generation of aircraft or whatnot, which means a lot to me.
Yeah.
Definitely shed a tear. Definitely shed a tear. But while I like the movie, I mean, it was nowhere near as good as the original, in my opinion. And so I might be in the minority on that. But man, old school Top Gun comes on. Yeah. If I see it as I'm flipping through the channels, then even my wife and my kids all know, like, we're not changing off of this, even though we have it on demand and have it on VHS and DVD and everything else. We're going to sit and watch it, commercials and all. And it's just, it's a part of it.
That's awesome. I don't think it was the Maverick was as good as the original, but in my opinion, I think it's one of the better sequels. Right, that's for sure.
I liked it. I did like it. It's just that it's got a lot to live up to, you know?
Oh yeah. Yeah, obviously. And I've already heard that they're doing another one. So
are they really? Oh my gosh. How much more can they extract out of the Maverick character?
Well, I mean, they're doing another Karate Kid, and I'm still not sure how I feel about it. I mean, originally I was excited, but the fact that it's going to have Ralph Macchio and Jackie Chan in it, so they're combining the original with the horrible remake.
Oh no. So
I don't know. I'll still watch it, but I don't know.
You know, you're going to go watch it. Yes, I mean, I'm going to go watch it. So it's, I guess, well, judgment can be delayed. I mean, we'll see how it goes.
Oh, yeah. I'll give it a fair shake. Like I said, I went in with no expectations for Cobra Kai, and it blew me away. So we'll see. But I'm not happy that they're combining the two worlds. I'm really not.
Yeah, I can share that. That skepticism.
Well, there we go. Well, before I let you go, anything that maybe I forgot to mention that you want to get out there quick? And like I said, I will put links for whatever you want me to once the episode comes out. But anything that want to get out there last minute?
Nothing that I can think of other than to say, for anybody that's in the local network, feel free to hit me up. I'm always looking for good guests. Everybody says that they don't have a story, but I promise you, everybody's got a story. And then also feel free to come and train. I train at the 55 location on the north part of the DFW Metroplex. If you could drop a link for 55 Highland Village, that would be awesome. Okay. Some of the best training that's around, one of the best professors and greatest human beings that has literally changed my martial arts journey in Rafael Formiga. And hope to see you guys there. So if you hear this and it speaks to you, then don't be a stranger.
Cool. I will do it. I will add a link for that one also. And like I said, I might have a couple guest ideas. I know I've interviewed at least one or two people from Dallas-Fort Worth area. So I'll have to dig through my stuff and see. I might have a couple of guests for you, but we will definitely be in touch. But I just want to say thank you. This has been a lot of fun, man. I'm glad we got to chat. I mean, it's always good talking with someone who's around my same age, because I know once you said Karate Kid, man, we're going to be friends for life. So,
oh, man, isn't that the truth?
Yes, that's very, very cool. When I talk to someone, they're like, I've never seen it. I'm like, go away.
Oh, no, I know. But, I'm kind of with you. I'm like, wow, that just really changed the shape of this conversation.
That's right. But seriously, from the bottom of my heart, I just want to thank you. This has been so much fun, and I can't wait to get the episode out.
That's awesome, Brian. Thanks very much.
Thanks for listening to Everyday Martial Artist. We hope you will join us every week for a brand new episode with a different martial artist telling their story. If you enjoy the show, be sure to leave us a review. Also, be sure to check out our website at everydaymartialartist.com. There you can find all of our episodes and contact us to suggest guests and ask questions. Again, thanks for listening to Everyday Martial Artist, and we'll see you next week.